Welcome to the podcast, Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels. Today, we'll be talking about one of the very few decisive battles of the Middle Ages, the Battle of Hattin. The Battle of Hattin was fought about 5 miles west of the Sea of Galilee on July 3rd and July 4th in the year 1187. In this battle, Saladin, the Sultan of Egypt and Syria, at the head of an army of maybe 30,000 men, virtually destroyed the combined military force of the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem. In the months following this battle, Saladin took all the coastal cities of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, except for Tyre, and then turned inland to take Jerusalem. In a previous episode, Ellen and I talked about how Saladin took Jerusalem. In this episode, my very special guest, Professor Nick Morton, will explain the military events that led up to it. Nick is a veteran of this podcast. If you haven't listened to his episodes on the Mongols' conquest of the Middle East and on crusading warfare, you should give them a try. They are both highly informative and entertaining. And when it comes to the military history of the Crusades, very few historians can match Nick's knowledge and analytical insight. So please join me in welcoming Nick back to the podcast. Nick, it is so good to see you again.
Thanks so much, Richard. It's great to be back on the show.
So let me begin briefly with some historiographical context for Western European warfare in the age of the Crusades. The big question is, what ideas about warfare did Crusaders and the rulers of the Latin states of the Levant bring with them from Western Europe? How did they think warfare ought to be practiced? And that brings me to historiography. Historiography is a scary word. If they weren't so disciplined, I know that my midshipmen would have groaned aloud whenever I would say, okay, it's time for some historiography. They signed up for a history class to learn about people and events in the past, not a course on the history of historical writing. But it's essential to understand that the historical discipline has changed and continues to change over time in terms of its practitioners, assumptions, methods, approaches to sources, and questions asked of those sources. This is particularly true for the military history of the Middle Ages, because the academic consensus has changed so dramatically over the last 75 years, and much of what the general public thinks about war in the Middle Ages is based on an old and now rejected understanding of medieval warfare. Throughout the first half of the 20th century, the dominant view of medieval warfare was that of Sir Charles Oman. Oman was a distinguished academic historian. He held the prestigious Chicheley Professorship of Modern History at Oxford from 1905 until his death in 1946. Oman's area of study was military history, in particular, the history of the art of war in medieval and early modern Europe. I should add, this was a time before military history had become the black sheep of the discipline. Oman saw the High Middle Ages as a sort of dark ages in the history of the art of war.
He was willing to admit that by the 14th century, there would be a rebirth in terms of military science. But what he called the feudal age, the period between 1066 and 1346, that period he saw as a period in which there really wasn't a military science. Rather, what you had were amateurs. Amateurs on horseback, wandering about without much of a purpose, seeking each other, not being able to find each other, and therefore contenting themselves with doing the only type of activities that actually were advanced in this period, and that was ravaging and sieges. The only part of the military art, according to Oman, that progressed was, in fact, in terms of defenses of castles and sieges. This is a view that has been contested, and contested seriously, in the second half of the 20th century, and we have a new orthodoxy, I think. And the new orthodoxy is Oman got it completely wrong. He didn't get it wrong that there were few battles. He got it wrong about why there were few battles. And he got it wrong that there was no military doctrine.
The historian probably most responsible for this new consensus is the British historian John Gillingham.
Although Gillingham himself was drawing upon a crusading historian, R.C. Smale, Gillingham's thesis, which was first published in an article in 1984, Richard I and the Science of War in the Middle Ages, and he chose this title really carefully. Richard I was Richard the Lionheart, but not in this article. And it's not even the art of war, it's the science of war. In this article, what Gillingham argued was that prudent generals in the 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries all followed what he called a Vigedian strategy, which is essentially a type of Fabian strategy, that drawing upon the writings of a late Roman military manualist, Vigidius, these military commanders chose not to seek battle. Instead, what they were doing was beginning campaigns by ravaging the enemy countryside, depriving the enemy of supplies in a logistical attack, and then besieging their major castles and fortified towns. So this was a warfare that was logistically based, in which battle was avoided. And the reason battle was avoided, according to Gillingham, is that it didn't make military sense. It was too risky. In an age in which commanders were expected to fight from the front, to risk battle was to risk the life of the commander. And like in the game of chess, if you lose the king, the game is over. Battles also didn't make sense given the military topography of Western Europe in this period, because Western Europe was dotted with castles and with fortified towns. And what Gillingham argued was that to win a battle did not necessarily advance you militarily, because what remained were these fortified towns and these castles, and it were the fortified towns and castles that actually controlled territory. To take territory, you had to take those castles and those towns. So the result was you had warfare, which had a lot of ravaging, a lot of foraging, a lot of sieges, and very few battles. An invading force would cross into enemy territory, would immediately begin burning the fields, collecting all the supplies they could. After all, they don't have supply lines. And after they had done this, they would then begin the sieges. The defender, on the other hand, the prudent defender, would maybe prepare for the attack by burning his own fields, Fabian strategy, but would take as many supplies as he could, withdraw his troops and the population into the towns and to the castles, and would defend them and wait for the invading army to run out of supplies and have to return, at which point they would then attack the enemy and do the same thing. And this was what warfare was like. It was not at all the way that it's imagined in movies. It was not the way that we think of chivalric warfare, knights on horseback, charging at one another and knocking each other off. That was the stuff of tournaments. That really wasn't the stuff of war. Would you agree that's the orthodox vision of medieval warfare at this point?
Yes, very much so. Certainly for Western Christendom. I've always had a little bit of a... I completely agree with the characterization you gave, though I've always had a slight... Not sympathy, but I understand where Amon's coming from, in the sense that it can give the impression that this is just warfare at random. It can look like these are just, to coin a phrase, bad men given license. This is about just smashing and grabbing.
And I agree with you. In fact, I think that you need, even for historiography, you need historical context. Oman was writing under the influence of Clausewitz and Jomini. Warfare was supposed to be like Napoleonic warfare, and it was supposed to be like maybe, you know, Crimean War, World War One. It was supposed to be battles.
Yeah.
That was what warfare was about. Everything else was sort of on the fringes of military activity, but it was all to lead up to the decisive battle. And what Oman discovered when he was doing his research, and he did really thorough research, was he couldn't find the battles.
Yeah.
He couldn't find the decisive battles. And he needed to explain it.
Yeah, because you're supposed to line up your tin soldiers who stand perfectly still until they're told what to do.
Exactly.
And then they move about.
Exactly. And it was frustrating to him because he also thought of armies in terms of the armies he knew, armies of soldiers, not armies of warriors. And in a sense, just reading some of the rhetoric he has, it's almost like he's offended by medieval warfare. Now, by the time that Gillingham was writing, we already experienced Vietnam and colonial warfare, and we experienced warfare in which there were few battles, but there was a lot of military activity.
Yeah.
And I think that that upset the Clausewitzian and the Jomini approach and understanding of warfare and permitted to look at the same set of data, but come to very different conclusions about it.
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that the most important starting point for understanding the military history, the two theaters I'm most concerned with are the Middle East and Western Christendom. But the starting point for getting to grips with this is firstly to recognize just how poor states are at this time.
Yes.
They do not have money to spend. And that's very true for Western Christendom. It's still true in the Middle East, even if the Middle East or the states there were proportionately richer. Once they've paid for a court or two, once they've got a few intellectuals and entertainers in that court, once they've raised a small army, that's it. They've spent their lot. There's no more money to go around. So armies are small, and so it's quite possible that, yes, by the time you get to the 14th and still more the 15th century, where people can start to afford bigger armies, it will start to feel more familiar to someone who's looking for a Napoleonic-style warfare with tens of thousands of toy soldiers to shift around. But that's just not true in the 12th century. No one can afford numbers like that. And I mean, we're going to be talking today about Hattin. That was a big battle, but it's extraordinarily rare in the Middle East or anywhere else that you get battles on that scale, and it's viewed as being profoundly unusual, and neither side can put forces in the field for that long. Saladin tried, and it almost broke him doing it because of the sheer administrative and fiscal demands involved in maintaining a force on that scale, even though it was in the process of conquering big commercial cities that presumably would have generated a great deal of plunder and additional financial input, I suppose.
And how exceptional Hattin is illustrated by when we look at the West in this period. We have a decisive battle at Hastings in 1066, and that battle is decisive because King Harold is killed and his brothers are killed. That makes the battle decisive. It's a battle which probably had on each side maybe 6,000 to 8,000 men, which when we think of modern warfare, doesn't even look like a battle.
No.
But that 6,000 to 8,000 men was also probably the size of the armies that fought in one of the great decisive battles, one of the few decisive battles of the 13th century, And that was the Battle of Bouvines.
Yeah.
It determines that fate, the political fate of Western Europe.
The King of France, Philip Augustus,
confronts a coalition army led by the Emperor Otto of Germany and supported by the money of King John of England. And in this incredibly important battle, you have maybe 1,200 knights on each side, and you have maybe a few thousand, maybe 8,000 or so foot soldiers.
Yeah.
And that battle determines the fate of Western Europe, at least politically. So what you have when we're looking at Hattin, because I'm thinking of what other really decisive battles, people love to look at Agincourt. But Agincourt's not decisive, 1415. The only thing that Agincourt really allows is that Henry V doesn't die and is able to go back to England. If you're looking at the Hundred Years' War, the only really decisive battle is Poitiers in 1356, and that's decisive because King John gets captured. That's it. Hattin, on the other hand, is not only a decisive battle, it's a large battle.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Hattin. Let's talk about battles in crusading warfare and how and why it's different from what we've seen in the West at this time.
Sure. So there's several points to make here. The first point is that there's a few, it sounds quite contradictory in many ways, because the Franks in the Crusader states, and we tend to call them Franks rather than Crusaders because
yes.
The Crusaders were the participants in the big crusading expedition.
And we call them Franks whether they came from France or not.
Quite so. And they were referred to as Franks, irrespective of whether they came from France or not. But the Crusader states are small. They're really small. In fact, one Western commentator said that the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the largest of the Crusader states, isn't really much bigger than a barony.
Yeah.
So the Franks in the Crusader states, they don't like fighting battles either. And they're living, and they're trying to hold on to this kingdom, which is no larger than a barony. And that poses problems. One of the problems is you can't retreat. If you're attacked, you've got nowhere to go. There's no depth for you to exploit in order to work through that invasion and then reassert your frontier afterwards. You either hold the front line or that's it. Your back's to the sea. And so despite the fact they don't like fighting battles either, they have, because they have no depth to retreat into, in many ways they're forced to fight because there's just nowhere else for them to go. But also, this is not very obviously a theater where you have simply Frankish armies against Frankish armies. The major armies of this era are those of the Crusader states, but primarily they are those of the Seljuk Turkish Empire and those of the successor states.
Right.
To the Seljuk Turkish Empire, which would include the Zangid dynasty and later on the Kurdish Ayyubids, and of course Saladin being the most famous of the Ayyubid leaders. And here's the point, that they have come from a very, very different background to the Franks. The Franks are predominantly from an agricultural society background where their knightly classes are a social elite who have to be equipped immaculately on very expensive war horses and with hauberks that cost a great deal of money. And if you lose those knights, you've got to wait for the next generation pretty much, or at least the next contingent of troops from Western Christendom to replenish them. And they're hard to replenish, not least because they also represent the major bureaucratic class in that territory as well. So right. For many of the same reasons that battles aren't fought in Western Christendom, they are not fought as well in the Crusader states, but in many ways it's even worse in the Crusader states because the Frankish population is so small.
Right.
There's no second line of defense. They can raise big armies, but if that army goes, that's it. There's nowhere else to go. There's no second line of defense. But for the Seljuk Turks and their various armies, it's a very different state of affairs. They come from a nomadic background where often their leaders very much rest on their military credentials. Of course, they do in Western Christendom as well, but this seems to be particularly the case among the Seljuk Turks and their various successor dynasties, and they seem to be a great deal more prepared to fight battles. And many of the battles, I've actually graphed out how many battles were fought. There's a lot of them during the course of the history of the Crusader states in the 12th century. And a lot of them, the largest group of those battles is fought on Frankish territory when the Franks are in proximity to a castle. So basically the Turks invade, the Franks fall back on their stronghold to offer the greatest possible deterrent, an army flanked by a stronghold.
Yes.
But at that point, if the Turks still want to fight, they're going to fight because there's nowhere else to go. And if the greatest possible deterrent isn't enough of a deterrent, then a battle will be fought whether the Franks want to fight or not. So battles occur all the time. Now, that's not to say that the Seljuk Turks and their leaders will fight under any circumstances. They pull back from confrontations too, if it's not worth their while. But nonetheless, their appetite for it seems to have been greater. And so even though the Franks in the Crusader states are arguably more battle-averse than in Western Christendom, who are already battle-averse, they still fight battles all the time because they have to.
There's a nice irony about this, of course, and you know that, that the argument that was made by Steve Murillo and Cliff Rogers is that battles did occur, but battles occurred when one of the commanders felt he had a real advantage over the other commander. And for whatever reason, the inferior army couldn't retreat. You know, it's back to a river or something, and then battle will occur. It's usually because one side has a real advantage in numbers. And in this case, in almost every battle we can think of and for the Crusader states, they're outnumbered.
In many but not all cases. But another dimension to this is that in some ways, the Seljuk Turks and the Izengids and Ayyubids, they can do a sort of, I'm not sure how to put it, they can sort of do a sort of trial on battles. They can see if they like it or not, because they normally open battles not by forming up in battle array, as it were, on the other side of the valley in a classic set-piece battle.
Yes.
Normally, they'll surround the Frankish army and then begin to stage a series of probing attacks with the various different sort of sub-commanders under the overall commander acting in a quasi-independent fashion. Now, if they deem it to be unsuitable for really pressing that attack home and bringing about a full-scale confrontation, they can just withdraw. So they can try out if this is going to work. If it's not going to work, they can just pull back and have lost virtually nothing. If of course the Frankish army shows signs of breaking or poor leadership, then they can press home their advantage. And if things go really badly, let's say a Frankish cavalry charge takes out one of their core contingents and they're obviously going to lose if they press their position, they're all mounted. And the Frankish army is mostly on foot. They can scatter. And so the consequences of defeat are far, far lower for an all-mounted army that is used to acting in a fairly sort of fluid structure. Whereas for the Franks, if they lose a battle with most of their foot soldiers on foot, then all those foot soldiers are going to get slaughtered.
Okay, so now let's turn to this particular battle, to the Battle of Hattin. Hattin was not the first time that Guy of Lusignan and Saladin faced each other militarily, nor was it Saladin's first invasion of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. 4 years earlier, in 1183, Guy, then bailiff of the kingdom, was entrusted by his brother-in-law, the ailing leper king, Baldwin IV, with the defense of the kingdom against a major incursion by Saladin. And that's probably where we ought to begin our discussion of Hattin.
Okay, so just to sort of a bit of setting the scene. So Saladin began his career, or he really sort of surfaces in the surviving sources for this era, as a commander under the Zengid ruler Nur al-Din. And he,
oh yeah, that really worked out well.
Well, he under his uncle Shirka conquered Egypt on behalf of Nur al-Din, and for Nur al-Din, this initially was an enormous triumph, except for the fact that once Saladin had taken power in Egypt, ostensibly as Nur al-Din's governor, he wouldn't accept orders. He wouldn't coordinate his activities with Nur al-Din, and Nur al-Din actually died in the process of raising an expedition to try and force Saladin to heal.
Yes.
But nonetheless, in later years, Saladin then advanced out of Egypt and conquered much of Nur al-Din's territory, forging an enormous empire by the standards of the day, an empire in military terms capable of raising up to maybe 25 to 30,000 troops, which is vast by the standards of the day.
Okay, we already have a problem here, though, because as I understand it, Muslims are not supposed to fight Muslims. And Saladin is spending this early military career basically waging war against fellow Muslims.
Indeed. I mean, it happens all the time. You have, I mean, it's not just Muslims fighting Muslims. You have plenty of examples of Christians fighting Christians as well. It's an underlying sort of, it's one of those things you hear about, particularly if you go to, I don't know, dinner parties or whatever, and someone asks you about what you do. When they tell you what they think they know about the Middle East in the period of the Crusades, it's almost as if you can get a map and draw a line down the middle with Crusader territory on one side and Muslim territory on the other. Yes. Of course, in practice, it's so much more complicated. I once tried counting the various major factions involved in the wars for the Middle East, and I lost count at about 30. But yes, there are so many occasions where it's Christians fighting Christians, or Christians fighting Muslims, or Christians and Muslims fighting Christians and Muslims. The battle lines are rarely simple, and it's certainly not as simple as just being Christians versus Muslims.
And Saladin does have a argument for why he's doing this. In order to be able to advance jihad, in order to be able to have an effective jihad against the Christian invaders, one needs to unite the Islamic world. And that's what he's doing. He's uniting the Islamic world in order for the ultimate mission, and the ultimate mission is the liberation of the holy city of Jerusalem and to drive out the Franks.
Yeah, that's certainly the line he takes. Although it's an important bit of context for Hattin that on the eve of Hattin, those arguments are starting to wear thin. He spent a lot of time over almost 2 decades, making exactly that kind of promise, and he hasn't delivered.
Yes.
He's landed no major blow against the Franks up to this point. He's had some fairly successful campaigns. He's had a couple of major battlefield victories, but he's lost some too. He hasn't taken much territory, and his position is beginning to look precarious. He has to realize that promise.
So in 1182, he does invade.
Yeah. So 1182, he invades. He's reasonably successful. Then 1183, he invades, and that he's less successful. The Franks essentially adopt shadowing tactics. He moves south, they move south. He moves north, they move north. They refuse battle the whole time whilst fortifying themselves in entrenched encampments. Saladin can't shift them, so Saladin is forced to withdraw, which looks bad for Saladin because he hasn't struck a major blow with his large army. And it looks bad for the Crusader states as well, because as far as they're concerned, well, why wouldn't they fight Saladin? Because as far as some people are concerned, at least they believe God will give them victory. So to hold back from battle can look pretty bad.
There is an argument that the one great victory that Saladin did get was taking Jacob's Ford.
Yeah.
And thus being able to dominate, well, basically the borderlands between the Islamic states and the Crusader states.
Yeah, sure. So in 1178-79, the Kingdom of Jerusalem under Bulban IV marches out beyond its borders in order to build a new frontier stronghold facing Damascus at a place called Jacob's Ford. Saladin tries to buy off the Franks initially. He had suffered a major defeat at a place called Montgisard in 1177, so only a little while before this. So he tries to buy off the Franks, but they refuse. And they build the outer skeleton of a stronghold, and this is when Saladin realizes he has to actually take the field to deal with this. And he does succeed in driving the Franks away, as you say. That gives him a degree of a stronger presence on the frontier territories. But it has to be said, he takes no territory. He merely prevents the Franks from taking additional territory.
Yes.
So it's a victory, yes, but he's got little to show for it, aside from the basic fact that he has successfully blocked a probe from the Kingdom of Jerusalem.
And 1187 is different.
The catalyst for Saladin's invasions in 1182, 1183, and 1187 was Reynold of Châtillon's truce-breaking raids upon Muslim pilgrim and trading ships in the Red Sea and on caravans. Reynold was one of the more colorful figures in crusading history. Neither King Baldwin IV nor King Guy was able to control him. His unremitting hostility to the Muslims may have been a consequence of his 15-year captivity in a Turkish prison in Aleppo after one too many raids upon Muslim caravans. At the time of his capture, he had been Prince of Antioch through marriage, but his wife had died while he was in prison, and with her death, he had lost his claim to Antioch. But Reynold landed on his feet because of powerful family connections. After his release, and it took a king's ransom to release him, he joined the royal court of Jerusalem and became a close political ally of the Queen Mother Agnes of Courtney and her son, Baldwin IV. Reynold married the heiress Stephanie of Milly and through her became the lord of Outre Jourdain, a large and loosely defined territory east of the Jordan River, whose main castle was Karak in modern-day Jordan. In the 1180s, while the Kingdom of Jerusalem was officially at peace with Saladin, Reynold ignored the terms of the truce and fought what amounted to a private commercial war. Saladin's invasion in 1187, as in 1182, was the consequence of a raid launched by Reynold upon a caravan and Reynold's subsequent defiance of King Baldwin IV in 1182 and Guy in 1187 to make restitution.
And at this point, Saladin had fairly good relations, at least with some of the great nobles of the Latin kingdoms. He seems to have had very good relations with
Raymond of Tripoli.
Yes, with Raymond of Tripoli. They had an agreement about not violating each other's territory. And it all changes with 1187 and this attack upon the caravan.
As Nick pointed out, Saladin was under enormous political pressure to make good his pledge to lead a jihad against the Crusader states. The truce he had contracted in 1183 with Baldwin IV had given Saladin time to build up his forces and consolidate his control over Syria. Reynold of Châtillon provided him with the excuse he needed to repudiate that truce.
Okay, so let's do some numbers.
Yes.
By 1187, Saladin can manage about 30,000 troops if he goes all in. That's his maximum. And of those, it seems about 12,000 were prime Turkish cavalry, with other forces making up sort of the auxiliaries to those. Kingdom of Jerusalem, it's not the same. Now, the Kingdom of Jerusalem, now, as I've mentioned, all states in this era are poor by modern standards, but by the standards of the day, the Kingdom of Jerusalem is small but rich. And its big port cities, places like Acre and Tyre and Beirut, they produce a massive commercial income that can support a large army, much larger than, say, even the Empire of Germany, or at least some of the Empire of Germany's armies. Kingdom of Jerusalem, if it goes all in, can manage about 20,000 troops, of which about 1,200 would have been cavalry, and of those, half would have been provided by the Templars and Hospitallers.
Can you tell us a little bit about the military orders and what makes them different from the ordinary knights of the period?
Sure. So in their origins, they began as sort of groups of, well, in the Templars' case, a group of knights, in the Hospitallers' case, a group of sort of charitable people providing medical care to people in Jerusalem. And they begin as religious organizations. So the Templars, as a group of pilgrim escorts, the Hospitallers providing medical care, but they both grow. They both grow and become formal institutions of the Catholic Church, And crucially, from a financial perspective, they begin to take on the model, the closest analogy to which would be a modern-day charity.
Yes.
In the sense that tens of thousands of people in Western Christendom hear of their work, like it, and then start pouring donations upon them, whether those donations take the form of money, land, or recruits. So the Templars and Hospitallers build up massive portfolios of estates in Western Christendom. Those estates, by turn, send a proportion of their income to the Crusader states, which provides massive revenues for both orders. The Hospitallers, by the time you get to the mid-12th century, they're still very committed to medical care, but they also supply large contingents of troops as well, which is why the Templars and Hospitallers become major providers of mounted knights and infantry. And from the Kings of Jerusalem's perspective, those warriors have two main virtues. The first is they're often very well equipped and trained. And the second is that from his perspective, they're free. He doesn't have to pay for them, which is helpful to a medieval monarch who, despite being rich by contemporary standards, is still short of cash.
And monastic discipline translates very well into military discipline.
Indeed, it certainly does. So you have this situation where the Kingdom of Jerusalem can raise a big army, but that's all it can do. If that army should be destroyed, there is no other army to create a second line of defense. And there's even reports of the King of Jerusalem, King Guy, actually stripping out garrisons from his castles in order to raise forces big enough to meet Saladin. So immediately the decisive quality of this battle becomes clear even before it's begun. Saladin, having been promising the successful overthrow of the Crusader states, has to make good on those promises. It's not unreasonable, I think, to suggest that a major defeat for him at Hattin would have been every bit as decisive for him and for the collapse of his position as it would have been for the Franks. So the Franks, they have to raise the largest army possible, 20,000 troops, not as big as Saladin's army, big enough to risk battle, or at least to face him. But they have no second line of defense. They either have to at least hold the line at Hattin, or there's nothing behind them. So that quality comes clear right from the start.
So Saladin crosses over into the territory of the Kingdom of Jerusalem and lays siege to Tiberias.
Yes.
And Guy collects his army and musters them at Safaria, which is how far from Tiberias?
It's something in the region of about 30 kilometers.
So it would have been a 1 or 2 day march.
You could do it. The idea is to do it in one day, but it's a stretch.
So the two armies are settled. One of them is besieging Tiberias.
While Guy of Lusignan has mustered his army, 20,000 strong, the entire military force of the Kingdom of Jerusalem at Safaria, or Sepphoris, the Arabic and Greek names for the site, 30 kilometers away. And Sepphoris is, at the time, a strongly defended site with sufficient water for both Guy's men and their horses.
And we're talking now about the beginning of July.
Yeah.
It's hot.
But it's hot. Yeah, exactly.
It's really hot. And the territory between Safaria and Tiberias is largely without water.
Yeah.
So a couple of questions. Why does Saladin focus on Tiberias?
Yeah.
And why does, we'll talk about why Guy leaves his base in a few minutes, but why focus on Tiberias?
Okay, so several reasons. Tiberias is a frontier town facing Saladin's territory. And it is a fact that nearly all commanders of this era, not all, but nearly all, will attack frontier strongholds without advancing beyond them until they have fallen. It seems to be almost like an unwritten law that even though, of course, they could simply walk around these castles, they don't. And there are military arguments for not leaving strongholds along your line of retreat. They could cut you off if things go badly, or they could try and relieve you of any plunder or livestock that you're trying to get back to your territory or they could cut lines of communication. So there are reasons for doing that. But yes, Saladin attacks Tiberius, but my feeling is that the main reason for that attack was not for any of those reasons. I think he had picked his battlefield. He knows that the kings of Jerusalem, like the rulers of all the Crusader states, they always march to the relief of a beleaguered subordinate. Always.
And Tiberius has in it the wife of Raymond of Tripoli.
Indeed. Now, of course, if the king were to fail to do that, that wouldn't just be seen as being cowardice or unchivalric or anything like that, though it would be seen as that as well. It would also be seen as a dereliction of the basic social contract between a king and that king's nobility.
And that brings us to the political situation within the Kingdom of Jerusalem and the relationship between Guy of Lusignan and the native barons. And Guy, after all, is an immigrant.
Guy had followed his older brother Aimery to Outremer. The Lusignans were a powerful noble family of Poitou in western France. In 1168, they had engaged in an unsuccessful rebellion against their overlord, King Henry II of England, and that included a failed attempt to kidnap Queen Eleanor of Aquitaine. Aimery thought it prudent to go east, and Guy followed him a few years later. Both prospered. Aimery married into the powerful Ibelin family and through them rose to the position of constable in the court of King Baldwin IV. Aimery, in turn, introduced Guy into the court, and Guy seems to really have impressed King Baldwin IV, his mother Agnes of Courtenay, and especially Baldwin's sister, the Princess Sibylla, a young widow with a young son.
Yeah.
Baldwin, wasting away from leprosy, saw the impressive young Frenchman as the solution to the problem of succession. He encouraged Sibylla's marriage to Guy, despite the opposition of Count Raymond III of Tripoli. Raymond headed a contingent of native barons who resented the influence of the Queen Mother Agnes of Courtenay and her relations, and believed that they could strengthen their political position by forcing Sibylla to marry a husband of their choosing. Sibylla's marriage to Guy derailed those plans. Baldwin IV demonstrated his support for and confidence in his new brother-in-law by appointing him bailiff of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Bailiff was the highest position within the royal household. The bailiff's duties included acting as regent if the king were absent or incapacitated. And given Baldwin IV's leprosy, Guy's appointment as bailiff meant that he would lead the army in defense of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Nick has already described how Guy of Lusignan fought a campaign of maneuver against Saladin in 1183. Guy's campaign was successful in forcing Saladin to withdraw, but his failure to confront Saladin in battle provided ammunition to Guy's critics among the native baronage, led by Count Raymond III of Tripoli, who had strenuously opposed Guy's marriage to Sibylla. A few months later, Guy lost the favor of Baldwin IV and with it his office as regent when he disobeyed Baldwin's command to relieve Saladin's siege of Reynald of Châtillon's castle of Corac. Baldwin replaced Guy with Raymond of Tripoli and, despite his failing health, personally led the relief army while being carried in a stretcher. As Nick pointed out, it was the duty of a king to come to the aid of a vassal under siege, and was particularly necessary in this case. Saladin had launched his siege during the celebration of the marriage of Reynald's stepson, Humphrey of Touraine, to Baldwin IV's younger sister, Isabella. Disillusioned with Guy, Baldwin IV attempted to get his marriage to Sibylla annulled, and when that failed, had Isabella's young son, Baldwin, anointed and crowned as his co-ruler. Baldwin V was a sickly child and died within a year of his uncle, and Guy, as Sibylla's consort, became king of Jerusalem in 1186, despite the attempt of Raymond of Tripoli to bypass him and place Humphrey of Touraine on the throne. As Guy once again faced Saladin in July of 1187, he ruled a politically divided realm.
Yeah.
He could count on the support of his brother Aimery, Reynald of Châtillon, Humphrey of Touron, who had refused the kingship, and Gerard de Riedfort, the master of the Order of the Temple. His political opponents included several of the most powerful native barons, notably Balian of Biblin and his brother, and at their head, Count Raymond of Tripoli and Prince Bohemond III of Antioch, all of whom were gathered in camp with Guy.
Guy is king, but as you say, he king in troubled circumstances. He has his supporters, and he has his detractors, and chief among his detractors is Raymond III of Tripoli, who's also a landowner in the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And Raymond's position is complicated by the fact that, as you say, he formed an alliance with Saladin a little while before Hattin, but then when Saladin used that alliance to stage a surprise raid on the northern district of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, Raymond thought better of it and came back on side with Guy. So there's trouble there. And of course, it's also Raymond's wife who's being besieged in Tiberias. And all of this sets the stage for a debate. And here's the problem with this debate. We only know about it from sources that are anti-Guy.
Yes.
And so it is tricky. But the sources basically say that a debate's held. And the question is simple. Should Guy march out with his army across this largely waterless zone? There are springs, but those springs are often seasonal and they're dry at this time of year. There's some water, but not enough water to feed a major army. It's not a desert, it's farmland, but it's farmland that's out of season. So he could march out and relieve Tiberias and with all the tactical problems that would entail. Or he could stay put in Sephoria and just wait Saladin out, or alternatively, he could even retreat to the fortified city of Acre, which would be a much stronger location. And these sources, of course, written in full knowledge of what happened next, and written by authors who are anti-Guy, they're very clear that Raymond III of Tripoli, despite the fact that his wife was in the castle under siege, said with enormous selflessness, "We must not march out because it's just too dangerous."
How noble of him.
Quite so. And of course, he's absolutely right, as the author writing those events knew after the event.
After the event. And on the other side, we have Reynold of Châtillon.
Yeah.
We have the master of the temple, Gerard de Riedfort.
Yep.
Saying, "You can't let this stand. You must go out." And R.C. Smale had argued that it was a bad military decision, but it was a bad military decision made because of a necessary political reality. If he failed to make this march, Guy would have lost the kingdom.
Yes, although, of course, it would be very selfless of Raymond III of Tripoli to... Yeah.
He sounds so skeptical. I can't believe. I mean, we're talking about these primary sources.
Yeah. So I'm very skeptical, and I've got my own reasons for being skeptical. Here are the reasons for my skepticism. Number one, Raymond III of Tripoli knows perfectly well that if Guy doesn't relieve Tiberias, he has broken his social contract with the nobility of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. He has become that most dreadful of things, a king who will not support a frontier noble when that frontier noble comes under attack. He knows this. My second objection is that the Kingdom of Jerusalem is actually very good. It's very experienced at marching through waterless zones. There is this weird perception that somehow the Franks are this... I mean, Guy himself may be a relative newcomer, but the Franks have been in the Middle East by this stage for 9 decades. They know perfectly well where they are and what the climate is like. And because they're fighting on home territory, they also know where the water is. Yes. It's not through a lack of familiarity that they, or an arrogance about their ability to cope with their surroundings that leads them to make this march. They've marched for days in the past without water. In 1147, Bulban III marched all the way to Bosra, to the southeast of Damascus, with the wells being smashed down en route and on the way back, but he managed it for days. So Frankish armies can cope with waterless zones, and they've done it before. They're also capable of fighting in a formation called a fighting march, or R.C. Smale dubbed the term a fighting march, which is basically like an enormous Roman tortoise. The entire army forms a sort of armored carapace and then just plows towards its target. And because most of their opposing armies in this era are formed from Turkish-like cavalry who are not well-equipped for a rigid line to bar their path, those fighting marches equipped with thousands of crossbowmen can normally cut a path through any target. In fact, pre-Hattin, I've only identified one occasion when any commander of any background was able to stop a Frankish fighting march. And that occurred in 1146 in Edessa. And that's only because the Franks broke their own fighting march, not because someone broke it for them. So they know various things. Yes, they know the area is waterless. They know that very well. Guy knows he has to relieve Tiberius, but also he knows that he can actually do it. Form his army up into a fighting march, plow straight towards Tiberius. No one has ever stopped him before, and he has no reason to believe they'll be able to do so now because Turkish light cavalry simply isn't set up to provide a permanent barrier to his line of advance.
What does Saladin do? His enemy has come out into the field. How does Saladin counter this? Or what does he try to do to counter this?
This is the thing. I'm going through what he knows on the eve of the battle. But the problem is Saladin also knows these things.
Yes.
And Saladin, I think Saladin gets a little bit underrated as a military commander. Sometimes he's set up as being a second-rate commander fighting a third-rate commander with Guy as the third-rate commander. Mm. But the way he comes up against Richard I, who's a first-rate commander, then he suffers very badly. Actually, I think that's that kind of characterization, which comes up quite a lot, is rather unkind to Saladin. I think he's a much better commander than he's given credit for.
And the same could be said for Guy of Lusignan.
Guy was much more effective as a military commander than he's given credit for.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're looking at here at not at a battle of the a battle fought between the mediocre and the poor, but a battle between two very competent commanders who know exactly what they're doing.
So Saladin's response then.
Okay. So the way Guy deals with this is once he's made his decision to march out and try and relieve Tiberius, he acts fairly logically, which is to march at the earliest possible hour of the day. The idea being to cover as much ground as possible, A, before Saladin knows he's coming, and B, whilst it's still reasonably cool. I mean, why would you want to fight at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a July day in the Kingdom of Jerusalem?
Yes.
So he actually covers about half the distance before Saladin's really able to make his own forces engage. And Saladin, his first move is fairly conventional, really. He brings a lot of his mounted cavalry behind the Christian army, and then tries to wear it down. And he's using entirely conventional tactics, hit-and-run attacks by squadrons of light cavalry archers, approaching within bowshot of the Frankish fighting army in its fighting march formation, loosing a few volleys of arrows, and then wheeling away, probably losing a few of their number each time to crossbowmen from the Franks' ranks. But continually doing that. The idea here is not to stop the Frankish army. It's just to slow it down. He doesn't want them reaching Tiberius on the first day. That's the main thing. And sure enough, it works. He slows them down until by sort of, once you got into the afternoon, the Frankish army is pretty exhausted. It's reached a village about two-thirds of the way along its route. So it's already gone quite a long way. And that village is called Muscana. Now, Muscana does have a spring. And that spring probably was operating at this time of year, but it's small, not nearly enough to quench the thirst of all those thirsty knights and foot soldiers, still less their horses. And this is the critical moment. The decision is fielded to wait at Muscana for the following morning or to press on. And again, there's various pundits from this era who suggest that their favored candidate obviously gave the advice to press on, whereas the ones who really made a mistake said, you know, well, let's just hold back to Muscana. But it's that decision to stay there overnight that places the Frankish army in jeopardy. It's not by any means the end of the battle, but by spending the night there, there's not enough water to rehydrate the army. it starts to get difficult. And here again, Saladin uses a fairly conventional strategy, but he uses it to great effect, which is he lights fires in the undergrowth upwind of the Frankish army. So all that smoke comes billowing down on the Frankish army. And of course, once that gets into your throat, it will parch you and only make it harder to deal with the effects of dehydration.
And I think at this point, we should also add that one of the downsides of a fighting march is that you have to travel in full armor.
Yeah.
And if we're talking about July 3rd, traveling, riding in full armor or marching in full armor, it's hot as hell.
Yeah.
You're being boiled, and you don't have the luxury of taking it off, and it makes the situation even more difficult for the army under attack.
Absolutely. And the Franks will undoubtedly have taken as much water as they can carry, but there's only so much that you can reasonably carry. And Saladin exacerbates it still further by actually getting his soldiers to bring up great pots of water from Lake Tiberias and then emptying them on the ground within sight of the Frankish army. So this places the Frankish army in straitened circumstances. Saladin makes sure the Frankish army is disrupted enough through the night so it can't sleep. And so it's a fatigued and dehydrated army that then rejoins the battle the following day. But they're not far away from Tiberias. They've had a rough time of it, but nonetheless, there's no real sign that anyone's got the upper hand at this point, even if the Frankish army is struggling. But the point is they have to push on towards Tiberias. But there's no particular reason to believe that they can't, because no one's ever stopped them in their fighting march formation previously. And for me, at least, this is the bit that needs to have a big, thick underline under it, because it's the important bit. The Franks resume their march. It seems likely the Templars were in the vanguard. And this time, Saladin does not position his forces behind the Frankish army. He positions them in front of it, and he forms an immobile barrier directly in front of the Frankish army. So what he's doing, and I can't stress this enough, he is basically saying that he is prepared to risk a frontal hand-to-hand confrontation with a Frankish army. Now, typically, Turkish commanders don't do this because their light cavalry simply isn't suited for a frontal hand-to-hand confrontation with heavily armored Frankish knights. Their strengths are in mobility and archery. The melee doesn't suit them nearly so well. But over the previous decade or so, Saladin has been building up his heavily armored contingents of both mounted and infantry forces. And so he's actually started to shift his emphasis from a largely mounted archer-focused army to a more mixed force that includes formations of mounted archers, but also those capable of close combat with an armament and skill level necessary to actually meet the Franks head-on.
And he sets this up on the Horns of Hattin.
Nope, he sets it up on the road between Mascana and Tiberias.
Okay.
And here is the point. This is what makes Saladin's strategy so fundamental. He's actually trying to block a Frankish army by creating a fixed barrier rather than just the sort of the hit-and-run attacks of light cavalry. And crucially, he succeeds. Now, he's weakened the Frankish army in advance, but it can't be stressed enough. He is actually able to bar the road. And that hadn't happened before. And it's then the Frankish army, when it realizes it can't break through, it then falls back on the slopes of an Iron Age fort just above their road, which provides some sanctuary but no water, which is called the Horns of Hattin.
So we have a demoralized Frankish army. And if I remember the sources, it says that the cavalry and the infantry have been separated. The infantry has lagged behind. And how does the battle now culminate?
Sure. So, yeah, the infantry and cavalry separate. The infantry sort of backs away from the battle, really. The knights and what's left of the army coalesces around Guy on the Horns of Hattin, and they fight all day. Saladin's forces surround Guy on the Horns of Hattin. Guy stages several cavalry charges, so do the Templars, down the slopes of the Horns of Hattin. Saladin's forces continually press upon them. There's one very sort of clinching moment where a cavalry charge is aimed at Saladin personally, and the cavalry charge down the slopes of the Horns of Hattin at him. But Saladin's learnt how to deal with this. He saw how his uncle did it in Egypt. And that is not to meet the Franks on this occasion, to meet the full force of their charge head on. He just separates his forces at the last minute. Because Guy's cavalry has built up so much momentum, they can't change course. So they go flying through the gap down to the bottom of the slope, where they themselves run out of energy, and then Saladin's forces close in upon them. The point is that they're not getting out, really. So yeah, one force does make it out from the Frankish army, rather suspiciously led by Raymond III of Tripoli, with whom, of course, had substantial relations with Saladin previously. The rest of the army is forced to surrender. Guy is forced to surrender. Raynaud de Châtillon also surrenders, as well as many of their knights and what's left of the Templars and Hospitallers. And that is the end of the Battle of Hattin.
And Saladin responds by holding Guy for ransom and actually treating him like a fellow king. He doesn't show the same mercy towards Raynaud of Châtillon. He has him executed, right?
Yeah, there's a sort of moment of high drama where he offers Guy a cup of water, which of course is somewhat ironic given the nature of the battle.
Yes.
I'm sure Guy must have been very keen to have it because he's been fighting for 2 days on very little water. But of course, by showing hospitality to Guy, Saladin's indicating that Guy is now his, well,
guest
is too, well, he is his guest, he's also his prisoner, but he's going to live. And Guy then hands the cup to Raynaud, and then Saladin intervenes at this point and says he hadn't actually given the cup to Raynaud. In other words, Raynaud is not his guest. He is not being offered his hospitality. And then Raynaud is killed immediately afterwards. And so indeed are the prisoners from the temple and the hospital in the immediate aftermath of Hattin.
Which is a sensible military decision, because that they're the elite military forces for the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And also, they're not going to be ransomed. And so there is no profit in keeping them alive.
There's a sense that the temple and hospitals are too dangerous to be kept alive, really. Yeah, so Saladin executes all of them. It's also a symbolic quality to that.
Yeah, Imad al-Din al-Isfahani has a story in which Saladin turns them over to the Sufis and to the jurists and basically the theologians, all of these people who are non-combatants, so that they can be blooded and have an experience of behaving as mujahideen. And it's a disturbing story because it's meant to make Saladin look good, but to a modern eye, it makes Saladin look savage.
It probably easiest to explain it with reference to a long-standing policy of just not letting Templars, Hospitallers, occasionally also crossbowmen survive as prisoners because they're just too dangerous.
It's too dangerous. And so what makes this particular battle so decisive?
Okay, so Saladin has won, and that doesn't just mean he's won a battle, it means he's vindicated. So he has proved his critics wrong. He has defeated the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and that then means that there's nothing, as you mentioned, with the Kingdom of Jerusalem having not just suffered a defeat, but the annihilation of its field army. There's nothing now stopping Saladin from marching on and conquering what's left of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Jerusalem itself falls a little while later, and within the space of a little over a year, there's only one city left from the former Kingdom of Jerusalem, that's Tyre. All the rest has gone. So it truly is a decisive defeat. It's not necessarily proof that all medieval battles can be quite so decisive. That owes a great deal to the specifics of the encounter and the fact that Guy had no other second line of defense to invoke. But nonetheless, it is certainly a decisive battle.
And that is pretty much it for today. And thank you very much. We've had an episode in which we looked at the big picture and we talked about what crusading warfare looked like as a whole, but it's always good to go and to dig in and look at a specific event to be able to understand what's really happening in terms of military events, military history. And that's what you gave us today. So
thanks very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. And I hope that you'll be coming back and we'll be talking again about crusading warfare.
Very happy to.
If you are listening on a platform that has ratings and reviews, please consider giving Tis But a Scratch a good rating and a good review. It's the best way, I've been told, of spreading the good news. Our next episode, I think, will be with another crusading historian, Steve Tibble, and it'll be on his new book about criminal crusaders. Until then,
bye for now.